dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It has been my distinct privilege and great pleasure to have been a comrade in arms, in a manner of speaking, in several phases of that war with our guest for this full hour. He is Andrew McCarthy, a former federal prosecutor who has emerged as one of the most sentient, thoughtful, articulate, and I believe influential commentators, analysts, authors, and pundits, among other things, about the nexus between national security and the law in particular. He comments on all manner of things, but that's a special focus and one that is of great importance to our country, I believe, and certainly to this audience. It's great to have him back. Andy, we're speaking to you as a newly minted, though repeat, best-selling author. Congratulations on the newest book, which is entitled Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. We're glad to have you back to discuss it, and among other things, welcome, my friend.
Frank, thanks so much. It's a delight to be with you as always, and thank you so much for the kind words.
Well, listen, they're heartfelt and justified. More to the point, they are of such surpassing importance as we talk about the subject of your new book. Ball of Collusion, as have you done in a number of other pieces, notably in your columns in the National Review, one of which is hot off the presses as we speak, is about a plot, a conspiracy. And having been savaged for some time myself as a conspiracy theorist, I've often remarked about something you've taught me that was, I think, an adage in the Southern District of New York, where you were an assistant U.S. attorney, chief assistant U.S. attorney, as I recall. Remind us about conspiracies and conspiracy theories, Andy, as you learned it there.
There are a lot of conspiracies, Frank, and you can't have a conspiracy without a conspiracy theory. So, you know, a lot of things are, a lot of plots that we think we perceive, I suppose, are not that. But on the other hand, there is a lot of nefarious plotting that goes on. And, you know, when we detect it, sometimes we're ridiculed as conspiracy theorists. But, you know, try having a conspiracy without one. I always remember judges at the end of our conspiracy trials explaining to juries, you know, the defense lawyers would tell the juries, you know, that's mere association. Mere association is not conspiracy. You have to have more to it than that. And I'd always be of a mind to say, well, that's fine. It's true. But try having a conspiracy without association. You know, you have to have these building block elements of it. And while there is a lot more to it, I think what we try to lay out and what you've just articulated demonstrates that there is a lot more to what we've seen in the last 3 years in connection with what was done to preserve Mrs. Clinton's candidacy in the 2016 election and what was done to hamstring both the Trump candidacy and the Trump presidency when that unlikely event actually became reality.
Yeah. Let me just put the context here. One of the conspiracies that you demonstrated in court, of course, was that involving the, well, I think you've coined the phrase Sharia supremacists plot to take down the World Trade Center the first time around in 1993. And this is one of those moments where I think as we pivot to the conspiracy that you focus on in Ball of Collusion, Andy McCarthy, it's important for people to understand you are a serious, accomplished, highly credible dot connector when it comes to these sorts of things. So congratulations again on putting away the blind sheikh and his team. But let's turn to this conspiracy, this plot, as you call it. It's unimaginable, really, I think, for most Americans that something with this kind of import could possibly have been mounted. The numerous players who were involved, the degree to which they collaborated over quite a period of time and got away with it, largely, at least to this point. So please just, you know, set the predicate for us here. How could that happen in America? And what did happen in this particular case?
Well, Frank, I think the way that official action, as opposed to flat out blatant criminal action, like, you know, mafia conspiracies or even terrorist conspiracies, the reason that when there's plotting that goes on by government officials, the reason that that has a much better chance of success is because it comes with a presumption of legitimacy and regularity. Because we want to believe that our agencies, our government agencies, our law enforcement agencies are doing the right things for the right reasons. So we're inclined, because we want to believe that's true, to assume that it's true. And also, when you're dealing with normal criminal law, you're dealing with situations where criminal statutes apply, and whether they've been violated or not is a pretty black and white proposition. You know, you rob a bank, you sell a package of heroin, you either do it or you don't do it. Whereas when you're dealing with official action, you're not really dealing with black and white rules and regulations. What you're dealing with are matters of broad discretion, where we endow the people who are our public officials, who represent us, who are members of these big agencies, the FBI, the Justice Department, the intelligence community. We don't try to micromanage their activity. We hope that we get good people in these jobs. We vet them before they get the jobs, and you hope that that's done in a fashion that's good enough that you don't get the wrong person in the wrong job. But once they have it, we give them a lot of discretion to act. And it's a lot more difficult to detect abuses of discretion than it is to figure out black and white criminal violations. And then in this particular instance, you lop onto that the added complication that they decided to do, particularly the Trump-Russia investigation, most of that was done as counterintelligence, which is classified. So it's even harder to get the facts.
Right. And I guess it goes without saying, but let me just say, the weaponization of these agencies that have the ability to wield criminal prosecutorial tools and do things in a classified domain does enormously increase the probability that if the wrong people are running them, and are engaged in that kind of activity, a conspiracy can get away with an awful lot. And we're going to talk with Andy McCarthy about how much has been gotten away with to this point by the anti-Trump conspirators in the federal government, and what must be done about it now. That and much more with the author of Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency, Andrew McCarthy, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back visiting for this full hour, I'm thrilled to say, with an old friend, much admired colleague, Andrew C. McCarthy. He is the author of numerous books. We'll try to talk about a couple of them in the course of this program, but I am very pleased to be able to focus immediately and most importantly on his newest best-selling book, Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. And Andy, you kind of set the predicate for us about how conspirators using agencies of the federal government who can, among other things, benefit from the doubt, I guess you might say, that they get, the benefit of the doubt, that is, to use their powers appropriately, and also can be concealing much of what they're doing from us under the guise of a classified counterintelligence investigation. But if you could, in a succinct way, introduce the nature of the plot, the principles in it, and how it played out specifically with respect to a very dramatic contrast between what was being done to President Trump, at the time candidate Trump, his campaign team, subsequently his transition team, subsequently his presidency, and on the other hand, how Hillary Clinton's campaign and her, you know, leader figures in it were being treated.
Well, Frank, I don't know that, you know, anyone ever sat down and thought this out in a comprehensive way. I think that the first phase of this was to get Mrs. Clinton elected president. And the thought, I imagine, was that as long as she's not indicted, and let's remember now, she was facing, I think, daunting evidence, incriminating evidence of mishandling of classified information, misappropriation of government files. She had she systematically designed a communication system through the homebrew private non-secure server of the 63,000 emails that were accounted for, at least numerically. That is, we know that those emails existed. She deigned to turn over on demand to the State Department only 30,000 and withheld and destroyed 33,000, which the FBI ultimately found contained thousands of government communications that she didn't surrender. So,
and some classified, right?
Yes, thousands of within that, a number that the State Department have, as they say, upclassified since then. But let's suffice it to say there were thousands of classified emails and, among the ultimate, you know, 60,000 plus. And Frank, that had to be something that she knew would happen. She was, you know, the third or fourth highest ranking official in the United States government. Her job involved foreign relations, military matters, national security matters, which means that a high percentage of what the Secretary of State deals with is classified information. It would be inconceivable to set up a system where you do all of your communications by this private, unsecure system and that you wouldn't have any classified information coursing through it. It was only natural that that would happen. So she was looking at that. And also they destroyed a number of these emails, Frank, the 33,000 that were destroyed. The timing of it is it was destroyed well after she had gotten subpoenas and preservation letters from Congress, particularly from the House committee that was investigating the Benghazi massacre. So she's looking at, you know, a lot of serious felonies, including obstruction of justice. And they essentially made that case go away. And when I say they, I mean the top officials of the Obama Justice Department with the FBI under James Comey and ultimately Andrew McCabe along for the ride. They essentially made that case disappear. They didn't really ever investigate it seriously. I think the line that Comey was trying to draw was to show that the FBI did a serious, credible forensic investigation while at the same time hoping nobody noticed that the case was essentially buried because they rewrote the statutes or simply ignored evidence to Mrs. Clinton's benefit. But the idea was to make that case go away. And I don't think they would have thought that they needed to do anything else other than make the case go away, because then she would win election and everything would go on as usual. What they didn't factor in was that she was an atrocious candidate. And it opened the door, I think, for the possibility of Trump winning, which seemed like a small possibility to them, but enough of one that they had to make a plan B for that, which is what they called the insurance policy.
The insurance policy, right. Andy, could I just back up for 1 second? What you've talked about clearly involved a number of the individuals that you've named, James Comey, prominently Andy McCabe, Peter Strzok, and others that one could list. A name that you haven't mentioned, and I just wonder, based on your exhaustive research into all of this, is that of Barack Obama. What did he know, and when did he know it, can we tell, about this plot?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, his fingerprints are all over it, Frank. But, you know, one of the things I must say I've been surprised about in the 2 weeks or so since the book has been out, and I've been talking about it a lot, is people act as if it's controversial to say that President Obama was, you know, was involved in this and knew about it. And I guess I'm a little frustrated about that, as an author would be, because when you're an author, of course, you assume everybody in America is just reading with rapt attention everything that you write, right?
As they should.
Oh, of course. Right. So the thing I've tried to hammer, and you and I have talked about this any number of times, Frank, the thing I've tried to hammer at from the beginning of this is that this was all done as a counterintelligence investigation. That is the Trump-Russia part of it. And the reason, even though that makes people's eyes glaze over because it sounds like inside baseball intelligence stuff and law enforcement stuff, it's an important distinction because unlike criminal investigations, which are done to vindicate the rule of law in judicial proceedings, and the whole goal is to make prosecutable cases, and there's lots of judicial oversight and congressional oversight, counterintelligence is done only for the president. There's no other reason to do it. It's not done to build prosecutable cases. It's not done to be in court proceedings. It is done to collect the information that the president needs to carry out his national security, constitutional responsibilities to protect the country from foreign threats. And therefore, if counterintelligence is being done correctly, of course the president is involved in it and knowledgeable about it. The more important the investigation, the more significant the investigation, the more likely it's coming to the president's attention on a regular basis. And I ask this question to people who seem surprised at this. If it was really true that Donald Trump was a tool of Vladimir Putin, if that was really absolutely true, as opposed to a fever dream, which is what I think we saw for the last number of years, how crazy would it be if Obama didn't know? How crazy would it be if they were conducting this investigation and he hadn't been told about it? People would look at that and say, there's something really wrong here.
Right. Heads would roll. And another data point, Andy, I don't want to get into too much of a digression here, but it's relevant to this point. Susan Rice, his national security advisor, on the day of the handoff to President Trump, the inauguration day, wrote what can only be described, I think, of as a cover her butt memo to herself, in which she as much as said President Obama knew and had said everything we've done to date has been by the book. Is that correct?
Yeah. In the book, I say that just as you do, Frank, that it's a CYA memo. And then I correct myself because it's really a cover the boss's butt memo. You know, the very interesting thing about it is, yeah, right. But the interesting thing about it is, it's, as you say, it's after she's out of office. It happens on inauguration day. She's 15 minutes out of power when she does it, but she still has access to government email and can write a memo to the file. And it pretends to be a contemporaneous rendering of a meeting that happened 2.5 weeks before, wherein Obama not only tells them, you know, everything has to be done by the book. Imagine you're dealing with people who you've been dealing with for 8 years and you tell them now everything has to be done by the book, right?
Well, I thought it was that he said that it had been done by the book. Was it sort of prospective?
Yeah. The president said we have to make sure we do everything by the book. And of course, he's talking to people who are quite indignant about the fact that they never do anything other than by the book, although it may not be the same book you and I are familiar with. Right?
It's not your book, that's for sure, though it does a fabulous job of describing what they were doing.
The more interesting thing I think she says is that Obama said to Comey and her, and very interestingly, by the way, Vice President Biden is also at this meeting. He says that we have to talk about what information about Russia we cannot share with the incoming team, meaning the Trump team. And in terms of what we're talking about here, the plotting that went on here, the challenge they had, Frank, was how do we keep this investigation going, this investigation by which we're hoping to hamstring Trump's presidency? How do we keep it going when he's going to be president and has the power to shut it down? And I think the way they decided to go about that was to not tell him everything the investigation was about and to try to give him a comfort level that he was not a suspect when, in fact, he was the main suspect. So, of course, Comey briefs him the day after this meeting and tells him a little sliver about the so-called Steele dossier, the part about the salacious episode supposed in Moscow. But he doesn't mention, you know, he doesn't say, oh, and by the way, Mr. President-elect, we've been conducting an investigation of your campaign on the theory that you're in a cyber espionage conspiracy with the Kremlin. And in fact, a couple of weeks ago, we went to the FISA court to get warrants to conduct surveillance on people connected to your campaign. And in fact, next week, we're going back to the FISA court so we can get another 90 days while you're president to, you know, to continue the investigation. Of course, they didn't tell him that.
Andy, we're going to jump from this into how the disconnect between how President Trump was treated and his campaign and so on. We're talking with Andy McCarthy. We'll be back with more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are talking with Andy McCarthy, the author, among other absolutely superb books, Ball of Collusion, in which he describes the plot to take down Donald Trump's candidacy in the first instance, and failing that, to disrupt and otherwise impede his presidency. A plot that, as he has documented both in this book and in his numerous articles at National Review and elsewhere, Fox News, is now being exposed as a very, very seditious operation, I believe. Andy, we were talking a little bit before the break about how the Trump presidency was, you know, afflicted by this from the get-go, including by James Comey, the then director of the FBI, being, shall we say, highly selective in what he shared with the president. Doesn't it go further than that? Isn't it there's active dissembling going on as well that really did begin to take down people, notably very early on, the president's national security advisor, Mike Flynn?
Yeah, Frank, I think there's the core lie that gets told here is they look Trump in the eye and they tell him he's not a suspect. And of course, he's the central suspect. And what we know from just what little has been disclosed so far, and it's very frustrating. It was difficult in writing the book, the number of things that we don't know at this point, that, you know, the paper trail that hasn't been exposed. But even some of Comey's advisors, one in particular at the FBI, objected to his plan to tell Trump that he was not a suspect, because he said, you know, look, we're investigating his campaign. He's obviously the central figure. We can't be investigating without investigating him. And in point of fact, that was a diplomatic way of putting it. He, in fact, Trump was the only reason there was an investigation. But they needed to tell him that so that he wouldn't shut it down. And, you know, that was only one. We talked earlier about, you know, the difficulty of detecting bad behavior by public officials. That was only one aspect of it, one aspect of abusing discretion. Another, for example, is picking out who you investigate and what for. So, for example, they went at General Flynn, who was Trump's first national security advisor. He had had conversations with the Russian ambassador, which he was totally permitted to have, and in fact was the right thing for him to do, because he was the incoming national security advisor and a key Trump transition official. His job was to conduct consultations with foreign counterparts, and yet they decided to treat him as if he were a criminal suspect on a theory that he had violated or was violating the Logan Act, which is an unconstitutional vestige of the John Adams administration that has been on the books for not only on the books for well over two centuries, has never resulted in a successful prosecution, and hasn't even been used in 170 years. And I think that's worth pointing out, since Comey told us that the reason that Mrs. Clinton couldn't be charged, even though she checked every box for a violation of the Espionage Act, was that it would be unprecedented to bring a case on the facts that he had uncovered against her under the Espionage Act. And here they are, you know, basically trying to nail Flynn on something that is not only unconstitutional, but, you know, only gets dragged out every couple of centuries.
Yeah. Andy, there's one important development of note here that I think we haven't mentioned, but I want to make sure we don't neglect it. This is another piece, it seems, of the insurance policy, specifically trying to make sure that Donald Trump couldn't shut down the investigation that they had begun in the pre-Trump presidency, namely to get a special counsel appointed. And you might just say a word about the lengths they went to accomplish that.
Well, you know, Jim Comey said that he leaked, I don't think it was classified information, but certainly sensitive government information. He leaked memoranda that he had prepared of some of his conversations with Trump, with President Trump, in particular conversation about General Flynn. He leaked that to the New York Times, and he did it. He himself has said in congressional testimony, in the hope of triggering the appointment of a special counsel. And I think, Frank, the reason that that so obviously happened is Comey was the one who was basically in charge of preserving the investigation after Trump became president. And his position became untenable because it was clear that Trump was a suspect. Comey was publicly saying things that would lead the media and the public to believe Trump was a suspect. And at the same time, Comey is privately telling Trump he's not a suspect. And Trump is trying to get him to go public with that, but Comey won't. And at a certain point, that just simply wasn't going to fly anymore. And once it was clear Comey was going to be out of there, they had the vexing problem of, all right, well, now what do we do to preserve this investigation? And the way they preserved it was to set up a situation where if Trump took any action against the investigation, he would be accused of obstructing it. And they brought a special counsel in as a kind of a monitor to conduct the investigation and dare Trump to shut it down, which, of course, politically would have been catastrophic. So it was actually, I think it was really quite sophisticated the way they went about it. The problem that they had ultimately was the whole thing was built on a fiction. There was no conspiracy between the Kremlin and the Trump campaign. And I think Bob Mueller had to have known that very early on.
Well, there is evidence that he did know it very early on, but chose not to act on it. And the investigation, of course, proceeded for, 2 years or so. Andy, when you look at this as a phenomenon in American history, clearly one of the things that jumps out at you is not only the miscarriage of justice that was taking place vis-a-vis Donald Trump, but the miscarriage of justice vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton. And in your article in today's National Review, I think you, with characteristic brilliance, I might say, really showcase how this double standard, this sort of two-tiered justice, is now really undermining confidence in our country's system of justice. And a kind of a microcosmic example of it would appear at the moment to be Andy McCabe, the number two under James Comey, who himself was a very active participant in this plot. Give us a sense of how the contrast between the way he's been treated, at least to date, and General Flynn, for example, would cause most Americans to say, well, what's up with this? How could this, double standard be allowed to continue?
Yeah, Frank, I want to say two things about this because I think you've hit on the most important thing, and I think it will set up the other things that you want to discuss a little bit today, which goes to why I got interested in this in the first place, which is really not about the 2016 election, even though it's inextricably linked. There's my original plan for writing this book was to do a case study of the Clinton emails investigation, a case study of the Trump-Russia investigation, and then defy people to say that the same quality of justice had been afforded in both cases, because it's ludicrous to think that that was true. And it's very clear that they bent over backwards not to make the case against Mrs. Clinton, didn't use the grand jury, cut deals with lawyers in order to get evidence rather than the way the Justice Department always gets evidence by, you know, issuing subpoenas and doing search warrants. Worked closely, the Justice Department did, with the Clinton lawyers. When people actually had incriminating information or incriminated themselves, rather than being prosecuted as they were in the Trump-Russia investigation, they were given immunity and, of course, clammed up. That was the reward. So all across the board, they do things that the government never does in a normal investigation. And it's clear to me that they were bending over backwards to not the case, which is evident enough when you find out that, you know, first of all, President Obama said in April of 2016 that he didn't want to see Mrs. Clinton get charged. And I think everything that happened after that is details. But what one of the things we know is that within a week or so of Obama's saying that, the FBI begins to write exoneration remarks about Mrs. Clinton, even though the investigation isn't nearly completed yet. They have over a dozen important witnesses to talk to, including Clinton herself. So the fix was in on that from the beginning. And it's a stark contrast to the Trump-Russia investigation, where people were squeezed like only the Justice Department and the FBI can squeeze them, including people like General Flynn and this hapless George Papadopoulos, this 28-year-old kid who they went after. You know, if you were a lawyer in the Trump-Russia investigation, you were thrown in the grand jury or you were prosecuted. Whereas in the Clinton investigation, they had a hands-off policy because they wouldn't want to interfere in the attorney-client privilege.
Including giving witnesses immunity, which is, as you say, just unbelievable.
You give them immunity to get you to surrender evidence. I mean, can you imagine Paul Manafort telling Andrew Weissman, no, I don't think I'll give you my computer? You know, I mean, he'd be spending the night in jail right after they, you know, ransacked his house and did anything else. But in the Trump-Russia investigation, that was the kind of thing that they indulged. And let me just jump to the part that I think is most important for our purposes, Frank. And that is, what drew me to this investigation is the fact that I worked national security cases the last 10 years that I was in the Justice Department. And I learned, I was a fairly seasoned prosecutor at the time that I made that transition. And what it taught me was national security matters are the one aspect of law enforcement's work where you have to be able to look the public in the eye and say, you can trust us with these enormous powers, to wield them fairly and to use them for the purpose that they exist for, which is only to protect the country from foreign threats.
Andy, we're going to pick up on that point on the other side of a break we have to take right now. Andy McCarthy, much more to come right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for the fourth and final installment of this extraordinarily illuminating and, I hope, quite impactful conversation with Andy McCarthy, the author, as we've been discussing, of Ball of Collusion, Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, the consummate professional that you are, you've brilliantly set the stage for a further conversation about the national security threats we're facing from enemies foreign and domestic. And I want to just say how much I admire the work that you have done over the years on both those enemies, foreign and domestic, notably with your books like The Grand Jihad. You have helped us understand in a way that very few others have the fact that the same sorts of forces that were at work in the Blind Sheikh's conspiracy are very much with us today. And it's not just in the form of ISIS or Al-Qaeda or the Taliban overseas. It's the Muslim Brotherhood. And that means the Muslim Brotherhood and its operations here in the United States. You've coined a phrase. I credit you with doing it. I use it shamelessly because I think it's the most apt way to describe it, building in part on our collaborative effort a number of years ago on a book we put together called Sharia, The Threat to America, in which you were a very important contributor, namely Sharia supremacism as the sort of common ideological underpinning for all of these groups, the violent kinds and what I think of as the pre-violent kinds. When you talk about the importance of having the wherewithal, the intelligence capabilities, the investigative powers of the FBI, the prosecutorial powers of the Justice Department, all available to protect us against these enemies, foreign and domestic, I just would invite you to talk a little bit about how we're doing in that department. Do we really even, in senior levels of the government, and I'm sorry to say even in this administration, adequately understand? Have we adequately articulated, have we adequately conveyed to the American people the nature of the Sharia supremacist threat we're facing?
Well, no, I don't think we have, Frank, but, you know, it's a mixed bag. And I say that as somebody who got into this when it was anything but a mixed bag in 1993. It was actually things were much worse than they are today. So I try to take the good with the bad. I think the frustrating bad part is what you've just articulated, which is that this is a threat which is still with us. And I know that everybody wants to flip the page and say we're now back to great power politics. We don't need to worry about terrorist organizations as if like somebody sprinkled the pixie dust and they're gone now. They're actually not haven't been able to hit us here because of a lot of good, hard work. And I'll get to that in a second because I think that's the part we need to salute. But the frustrating part has always been and remains that this is an ideologically driven threat, and we're living under a bipartisan dogma for the last generation that there is no that we either can't or shouldn't look for an ideological nexus when it's actually the only thing that explains the threat and the only thing that ties the atrocities and the greater, broader threat to us together. So, you know, if you don't take the time to understand what the enemy is trying to accomplish and why, you're always back on your heels. And I think we spend a lot too much time back on our heels because we don't want to look at ideology. And it's actually fascinating that that's the case, because the left, for example, in this country is quite willing to look at ideology if they think that they can score the points that Republicans or conservatives are the cause of the gun violence or whatever else. You know, then ideology is the only thing. But with respect to this thing that actually does carry out mass murder attacks and would carry out mass murder attacks if it had the slightest chance here, they don't want to look at ideology, and it's like fighting in the blind. Let me then flip to the silver lining side, which is, we are so much better at defending ourselves today. The information sharing between intelligence and law enforcement services is so much better than it was when I started this in 1993 as a prosecutor, as to be night and day. It's even better, Frank, in the sense that, you know, in 1993, when the enemy got to the front line, you know, he didn't find, you know, General Mattis. He found me. which is a problem for the country, right?
Well, thank God he found you as opposed to lesser prosecutors. But still, you're right. No, this is not just a law enforcement problem.
Yeah. So I think we're better at sharing intelligence, and we've melded, not perfectly, but we've melded the idea of, you know, military responses, intelligence responses, and law enforcement playing a support role instead of the point of the spear. That part of it is very good. But what I worry about, you know, just to go back to the beginning, is the age of great power politics may be on, but the great power politics has always included no small amount of terrorism, which the Soviet Union, for example, was a major sponsor of. So the thought that even if we could flip the page, which I don't think we can, the thought that that would make the terrorist threat go away is loony to me.
Yeah. Andy, as a serious student of these matters, I want to just broaden the lens a little bit, and I think it has something to do with what you were talking about a moment ago, which is the pass that the left often now gives to the Islamists. And we have, among others, promoted this think conclusion that what you are really dealing with here is what, for want of a better expression, is a red-green axis, an alliance of sorts, unlikely though it may seem, between the hard left on the one hand and the jihadists on the other, the Sharia supremacists. This is, it's clear, manifesting itself, among other ways, in the vicious attacks to which people like thee and me have been subjected by organizations of the hard left, like the Southern Poverty Law Center, and organizations of the Muslim Brotherhood, like the Council on American Islamic Relations and its ilk. You have, again, probably done more than just about anybody, Andy, to break through the efforts to silence those of us who are making these kinds of points, connecting these kinds of dots, raising the alarm about these kinds of enemies, domestic as well as foreign. And yet, it's indisputably the case that we're all intensively being suppressed, if not actually silenced. Talk a little bit about what that means for a polity that requires the American people to be informed about these sorts of dangers if they're going to have any prospect of actually insisting that they be met in appropriate ways, forcefully if need be.
We're really a society, self-governing society, that is built on the idea of the free exchange of information and ideas. And it's supposed to be that if you, as long as you stay on the right side of the incitement line, you should be able to articulate any political idea, good or bad, and we're supposed to test it in the arena of ideas. We're not a society that suppresses ideas, and we're particularly not a society that suppresses ideas that go to our most important decisions, which are the decisions of a body politic makes about its security. And what I'm really worried about, Frank, and this is something that I'm afraid is not a law problem and a national security. I mean, it has national security consequences, but the nature of it is really a cultural problem more than anything else. And what I worry about is that the totalitarian left is really it's very smart in the sense that it targets, you know, the bedrocks of our society. And one of the main bedrocks it has targeted is free expression. It has tried to make certain ideas radioactive by kind of smothering them in the idea that they're, you know, racist ideas and the like. And, you know, their idea is that you have to shut down expression and shut down conversation and shut down dissent and basically demagogue it down or shout it down or what have you. And that was a frivolous idea 30 years ago. And what I worry about is that it's now a dominant idea on the campus.
Andy McCarthy, we're out of our time with you today. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your visiting with us at such length. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us, please, soon, if you will. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.